This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The Wicked Deep, written by Shay Earnshaw, performed by Casey Turner. To my parents, for encouraging my reckless imagination. If there is magic on this planet, it is contained in water. Lauren Isley. The Sea. Three sisters arrived in Sparrow, Oregon in 1822 aboard a fur trading ship named the Lady Astor, which sank later that year in the harbor just beyond the Cape. They were among the first to settle in the newly founded coastal town, and they strode onto the new land like thin-legged birds with wavy caramel hair and pastel skin. They were beautiful, too beautiful, the townspeople would later say. Marguerite, Aurora, and Hazel fell in love often, and typically with the wrong men, those whose hearts already belonged to someone else. They were coquettes, temptresses, and men found them impossible to resist. But the townspeople of Sparrow found the sisters to be much more. They believed them to be witches, casting spells on the men to make them unfaithful. And so at the end of June, when the moon was nothing but a thin shard in the overcast sky, stones were tied to the sisters' ankles, and they were dropped into the ocean just beyond the cape, where they sank to the bottom and drowned, just like the ship they arrived on. Chapter 1. I have an old black-and-white photograph taken in the 1920s of a woman at a traveling circus floating in a massive tank filled with water, blonde hair billowing around her head, legs hidden by a false mermaid's fin made of metallic fabric and thread to look like scales. She is wispy and angelic, with thin lips pinched tightly together, holding her breath against the icy water. Several men stand in front of the glass tank, staring at her as if she were real, so easily fooled by the spectacle. I think of this photograph every spring, when murmurs begin to circulate through the town of Sparrow about the three sisters who were drowned beyond the maw of the harbor, past Lumiere Island, where I live with my mother. I imagine the three sisters floating like delicate ghosts in the dark shadows beneath the water's surface, mercurial and preserved just like the sideshow mermaid. Did they struggle to stay above the waterline 2 centuries ago, when they were forced into the deep? Or did they let the weight of each stone carry them swiftly to the cold, rocky bottom of the Pacific? A morning fog, somber and damp, slides over the surface of the ocean between Lumiere Island and the town of Sparrow. The water is calm as I walk down to the dock and begin untying the skiff, a flat-bottomed boat with 2 bench seats and an outboard motor. It's not ideal for maneuvering in storms or gales, but fine as a runner into town and back. Otis and Olga, 2 orange tabby cats who mysteriously appeared on the island as kittens 2 years back, have followed me down to the water, mewing behind me as if lamenting my departure. I leave every morning at this time, motoring across the bay before the bell rings for first period, global economics class, a subject that I will never use, and every morning they follow me to the dock. The intermittent beam of light from the lighthouse sweeps over the island, and for a moment, it brushes across a silhouette standing on the rocky western shore atop the cliff. My mother. Her arms are crossed in her knobby camel-colored sweater, wrapped tightly around her fragile torso, and she's staring out at the vast Pacific like she does each morning, waiting for someone who will never return. My father. Olga rubs up against my jeans, arching her bony back and raising her tail, coaxing me to pick her up. But I don't have time. I pull the hood of my navy blue rain slicker up over my head, step into the boat, and yank the cord on the motor until it sputters to life. Then steer the boat out into the fog. I can't see the shore or the town of Sparrow through the dim layer of moisture, but I know it's there. Tall, sawtooth masts rise up like swords from the water. Landmines. Shipwrecks of years past. If you didn't know your way, you could run your boat into any of the half-dozen wrecks still haunting these waters. Beneath me, lies a web of barnacle-crusted metal, links of rusted chain trailing over broken boughs, and fish making their homes in rotted portholes, the rigging long since eaten away by the salty water. It's a graveyard of ships. But like the local fishermen chugging out through the dreary fume into the open sea, I can navigate the bay with my eyes pinched shut against the cold. The water is deep here. Massive ships used to bring in supplies through this port, but not anymore. Now, only small fishing boats and tourist barges sputter through. These waters are haunted, the seamen still say. And they're right. The skiff bumps against the side of Dock 11, slip number 4, where I park the boat while I'm in class. Most 17-year-olds have driver's licenses and rusted-out cars they found on Craigslist or that were handed down from older siblings. But instead, I have a boat, and no use for a car. I sling my canvas bag over my shoulder, weighted down with textbooks, and jog up the gray, slick streets to Sparrow High School. The town of Sparrow was built where two ridges come together, tucked between the sea and the mountains, making mudslides all too common here. One day, it will likely be washed away completely. It will be pushed down into the water and buried beneath 40 feet of rain and silt. There are no fast food chains in Sparrow, no shopping malls or movie theaters, no Starbucks, although we do have a drive-through coffee hut. Our small town is sheltered from the outside world, trapped in time. We have a whopping total population of 2,024, but that number increases greatly every year on June 1st, when the tourists converge into town and overtake everything. Rose is standing on the sloping front lawn of Sparrow High, typing on her cell phone. Her wild cinnamon-red hair springs from her head in unruly curls that she loathes. But I've always envied the lively way her hair cannot be tamed or tied up or pinned down, while my straight, nut-brown hair cannot be coaxed into any sort of bouncy, cheerful configuration. And I've tried. But stick-straight hair is just stick-straight hair. "You're not ditching me tonight, are you?" she asks when she sees me, tenting both eyebrows and dropping her cell into her once-white book bag that's been scribbled with Sharpie and colored markers so that it's now a collage of swirly midnight blues and grassy greens and bubblegum pinks, a colorful graffiti art that has left no space untouched. Rose wants to be an artist. Rose is an artist. She's determined to move to Seattle and attend the Art Institute when we graduate. And she reminds me almost weekly of the fact that she doesn't want to go alone, and I should come with her and be her roommate, to which I've skillfully avoided committing since freshman year. It's not that I don't want to escape this rainy, dreadful town, because I do. But I feel trapped. A weight of responsibility settled firmly over me. I can't leave my mother all alone on the island. I'm all she has left. The only thing still grounding her to reality. And perhaps it's foolish, naive even, but I also have hope that perhaps my father will return someday. He'll magically appear on the dock and stroll up to the house as if no time has passed. And I need to be here in case he does. But as our junior year comes to an end and our senior year approaches, I'm forced to consider the rest of my life and the reality that my future might be right here in Sparrow. I might never leave this place. I might be stuck. I'll stay on the island, reading fortunes from the smeared remains of tea leaves in white porcelain cups, just like my mom used to do before Dad vanished and never came back. Locals would steer their boats across the harbor, sometimes in secret under a ghost moon, sometimes in the middle of the day because they had an urgent question they needed answered. And they'd sit in our kitchen, fingers tapping on the wood block table, waiting for Mom to tell them their fate. And afterward, they'd leave folded or crumpled or flattened bills on the table just before they left. Mom would slide the money into a flour tin she kept on the shelf next to the stove. And maybe this is the life I'm destined for. sitting at the kitchen table, the sweet scent of chamomile or orange lavender tea settling into my hair, running my finger around the rim of a mug, and finding messages in the swirling chaos of leaves. I've glimpsed my own future in those leaves many times. A boy blowing in from across the sea, shipwrecked on the island, his heart beating wildly in his chest, his skin made of sand and wind, and my heart unable to resist. It's the same future I've seen in every cup of tea since I was 5, when my mom first taught me to decipher leaves. "Your fate lies at the bottom of a teacup," she had often whispered to me before shooing me off to bed. And the idea of this future stirs inside me whenever I think about leaving Sparrow, like the island is drawing me back, my fate rooted here. It's not ditching if I never said I'd go, I say in response to Rose's question. "I won't allow you to miss another swan party." She shifts her hips to the side, looping her right thumb around the strap of her book bag. "Last year I was stuck talking to Hannah Potts until sunrise, and I won't do it again." "I'll think about it," I say. The swan party has always served a double purpose. The start of the swan season, and also the end of the school year bash. It's a booze-fueled celebration that is an odd mix of excitement to be free of classes and teachers and pop quizzes, blended with the approaching dread of the swan season. Typically, people get way too smashed and no one remembers any of it. No thinking, just doing. When you think about things too long, you just talk yourself out of them. She's right. I wish I wanted to go. I wish I cared about parties on the beach. But I've never felt comfortable at things like this. I'm the girl who lives on Lumiere Island, whose mom went mad and dad went missing, who never hangs out in town after school, who would rather spend her evening reading tide charts and watching boats chug into port than chugging beers with people I barely know. "You don't even have to dress up if you don't want to," she adds. Dressing up was never an option anyway. Unlike most locals in Sparrow, who keep a standby early 1800s costume tucked away in the back of their closets in preparation for the yearly swan party, I do not. The warning bell for first period rings, and we follow the parade of students through the main front doors. The hallway smells like floor wax and rotting wood. The windows are single pane and drafty, the wind rattling the glass in the frames every afternoon. The light fixtures blink and buzz. None of the lockers close because the foundation has shifted several degrees off-center. If I had known another town, another high school, I might find this place depressing. But instead, the rain that leaks through the roof and drips onto desks and hallway floors during winter storms just feels familiar, like home. Rose and I don't have first period together, so we walk to the end of A Hall, then pause beside the girls' bathroom before we part ways. "I just don't know what I'll tell my mom," I say, scratching at a remnant of Blueberry Blitz nail polish on my left thumb that Rose made me paint on 2 weeks back at her house during one of our movie nights, when she decided that to fit in as a serious art major in Seattle, she needed to watch classic Alfred Hitchcock movies. As if scary black-and-white films would somehow anoint her as a serious artist. "Tell her you're going to a party, that you actually have a life. Or just sneak out. She probably won't even notice you're gone." I bite the side of my lip and stop picking at my nail. The truth is, leaving my mom alone for even one night makes me uneasy. What if she woke up in the middle of the night and realized I was no longer asleep in my bed? Would she think I had disappeared just like my dad? Would she go looking for me? Would she do something reckless and stupid? "She's stuck on that island anyway," Rose adds. "Where is she going to go? It's not like she's just going to walk out into the ocean." She pauses, and we both stare at each other. Her walking out into the ocean is precisely what I'm afraid of. "What I mean," Rose corrects, "is that I don't think anything will happen if you leave her for one night, and you'll be back right after sunrise." I look across the hall to the open doorway of my first period global economics class, where nearly everyone is already in their seats. Mr. Grattan is standing at his desk, tapping a pen on a stack of papers, waiting for the final bell to ring. "Please," Rose begs. "It's the biggest night of the year, and I don't want to be the loser who goes solo again." A slight lisp trails over the word solo. When Rose was younger, she talked with a lisp. All her S's sounded like TH's. In grade school, kids used to tease her whenever a teacher asked her to speak out loud in front of the class. But after regular visits to a speech therapist up in Newport 3 days a week during her first years of high school, suddenly it was like she stepped out of her old body and into a new one. My awkward, lisping best friend was now reborn, confident and fearless. And even though her appearance didn't really change, she now radiated like some beautiful exotic species of human that I didn't recognize, while I stayed exactly the same. I have this sense that someday we won't even remember why we were friends in the first place. She will float away like a brightly colored bird living in the wrong part of the world. And I will stay behind, gray-feathered and sodden and wingless. "Fine," I relent, knowing that if I skip another swan party, she might actually disown me as her only friend. She grins widely. "Thank God. I thought I was going to have to kidnap you and drag you there." She shifts her book bag higher onto her shoulder and says, "See you after class." She hurries down the hall just as the final bell chimes from the tiny overhead speakers. Today is only a half day, first and second period, because today is also the last day of school before summer break. Tomorrow is June 1st, and although most high schools don't start their summer sessions so early, the town of Sparrow began the countdown months ago. Signs announcing festivals in honor of the Swan Sisters have already been hung and draped across the town square and over storefront windows. Tourist season starts tomorrow, and with it comes an influx of outsiders and the beginning of an eerie and deadly tradition that has plagued Sparrow since 1823, ever since the three Swan Sisters were drowned in our harbor. Tonight's party is the start of a season that will bring more than just tourist dollars. It will bring folklore and speculation and doubt about the town's history. But always, every year without fail or falter, it also brings death. A song. It starts as a low croon that rolls in with the tide, a sound so faint it might just be the wind blowing through the clapboard shutters, through the portholes of docked fishing boats, and into narrow cracks along sagging doorways. But after the first night, the harmony of voices becomes undeniable, an enchanting hymn sailing over the water's surface, cool and soft and alluring. The Swan Sisters have awakened. Chapter 2. The doors of Sparrow High are flung open just before noon, and a raucous parade of students is set loose into the sticky midday air. Shouts and whoops of excitement echo across the school grounds, scattering the seagulls perched along the stone wall that borders the front lawn. Only half the senior class even bothered to show up for the final day, but the ones who did tear out pages from their notebooks and let the wind carry them away, a tradition to mark their freedom from high school. The sun sits lazy in the sky, having burned through the morning fog, and it now seems defeated and weary, unable to warm the ground or our chilled faces. Rose and I stomp down Canyon Street in our rain boots, jeans tucked inside to keep them dry, with our coats unzipped, hoping the day will brighten and warm the air before tonight's all-night bash, which I am still not entirely thrilled to attend. On Ocean Avenue, we turn right and then stop at the next corner, where Rose's mom owns a shop that sits like a little square cake with white painted brick walls and pink eaves, and where Rose works every day after school. The sign above the glass door reads, Alba's Forgetful Cakes, and pale pink frosting swirled letters on a cream-colored background. Yet the wood sign has started to collect a greenish brine that will need to be scrubbed away, a constant battle against the salty, slimy air. "I only have a 2-hour shift," Rose says, hoisting her book bag over to the other shoulder. "Meet at 9 on the dock?" "Sure. You know, if you had a cell phone like a normal person, I could just text you later." "Cell phones don't work on the island," I point out for the 100th time. She blows out an exasperated breath, which is catastrophically inconvenient for me, as if she were the one who had to endure the lack of cell service. "You'll survive," I say with a smirk, and she smiles back, the freckles across her nose and upper cheeks, catching the sunlight like constellations of golden sand. The door behind her whips open with a fluttering of chimes and bells clinking against the glass. Her mom, Rosalie Alba, steps out into the sunlight, blocking her gaze with a hand as if she were seeing the sun for the first time since last summer. "Penny?" Mrs. Alba says, dropping her hand. "How is your mother?" "The same," I admit. Mrs. Alba and my mom were friends once, in a very casual way. Sometimes they'd meet for tea on Saturday mornings, or Mrs. Alba would come out to Lumiere Island, and she and my mom would bake biscuits or blackberry pie when the thorny blackberry bushes began to overtake the island, and my dad would threaten to burn them all down. Mrs. Alba is also one of the only people in town who still asks about my mom, who still cares. It's been 3 years since my father disappeared, and it's as if the town has forgotten about him entirely, like he never lived here at all. But it's far easier to endure their blank stares than it was to hear the rumors and speculation that spun through town in the days after he vanished. "John Talbot never belonged here in the first place," people had whispered. "He abandoned his wife and daughter. He always hated living in Sparrow. He ran away with another woman. He went mad living on the island and waded out into the sea. He was an outsider, and he had never been fully accepted by the locals. They seemed relieved when he was gone, as if he deserved it. But Mom had grown up here, gone to Sparrow High, then met my father in college in Portland. They were in love, and I know he never would have abandoned us. We were happy. He was happy. Something far stranger happened to him 3 years ago. One day he was here. The next, he wasn't." "Will you give this to her?" Mrs. Alba asks, extending her palm where she's holding a small pink box with white polka dot ribbon. I take it from her, running the ribbon through my fingertips. "What flavor?" "Lemon and lavender, a new recipe I've been experimenting with." Mrs. Alba does not bake ordinary cakes for ordinary cravings. Her tiny, forgetful cakes are intended to make you forget the worst thing that's ever happened to you, to wipe away bad memories. I'm not entirely convinced they actually work, but locals and summer tourists devour the tiny cakes as if they were a potent cure, a remedy for any unwanted thought. Mrs. Potts, who lives in a narrow house on Alabaster Street, claims that after eating a particularly decadent chocolate fig basil cake, she no longer could recall the day her neighbor, Wayne Bailey's dog, bit her in the calf and made her bleed, leaving a scar that looks like a spire of lightning. And Mr. Riviera, the town postman, says he only vaguely recollects the day his wife left him for a plumber who lives in Chestnut Bay, an hour's drive north. Still, I suspect it might only be the heaping cups of sugar and peculiar flavors in Mrs. Alba's cakes that for a brief moment allow a person to think of nothing else but the intermixing earthiness of lavender and the tartness of lemon, which not even their worst memories can rise above. When my father vanished, Mrs. Alba began sending me home with every flavor of cake imaginable: raspberry lime tart, hazelnut espresso, seaweed coconut, in hopes they might help my mother forget what had happened. But nothing has broken through her grief, a stiff cloud not easily carried away with the wind. "Thank you," I say, and Mrs. Alba smiles her wide, toothy grin. Her eyes are like pools of chocolate, and her skin like café au lait. Mrs. Alba is Spanish, but Rose's father is true-blooded Irish, born in Dublin, and Rose managed to get all her father's features, much to her displeasure. "See you at 9, I say to Rose, and she and her mom vanish into the shop to bake as many forgetful cakes as they can before the tourists arrive tomorrow morning by the busload. The eve before the start of salon season has always felt burdensome to me. It's like a dark cloud I can't shake. The knowing of what's coming, the death that creeps up over the town like fate clawing at the door of every shop and home. I can feel it in the air, in the spray of the sea, in the hollow spaces between raindrops. The sisters are coming. Every room at the 3 bed and breakfasts along the bayfront is booked solid for the next 3 weeks until the end of swan season, which will come on midnight of the summer solstice. Rooms facing the sea go for twice what can be charged for the rooms facing inland. People like to push open their windows and step out onto their balconies to hear the beckoning call of the swan sister singing from the deep harbor. A handful of early tourists have already found their way into Sparrow, dragging their luggage into lobbies or snapping photos of the harbor, asking where to get the best coffee or hot cup of soup because their first day in town usually feels the coldest, a chill that settles between the bones and won't go away. I hate this time of year, as do most locals, but it's not the influx of tourists that bothers me. It's the exploitation, the spectacle of a season that is a curse on this town. At the dock, I toss my book bag onto one of the bench seats inside the skiff. All along the starboard side, dotted into the white paint, are scrapes and dings like Morse code. My dad used to repaint the skiff every spring, but it's been neglected for the last 3 years. Sometimes I feel just like that hull, scarred and dented and left to rust since he vanished somewhere out at sea. I place the small cake box onto the seat beside my bag, and then walk around to the bow, about to untie the front line, when I hear the hollow clump of footsteps moving down the dock behind me. I'm still holding the bow line when I notice a boy standing several feet back, holding what looks like a crumpled piece of paper in his left hand. His face is partly obscured by the hood of his sweatshirt, and a backpack hangs heavy from his shoulders. "I'm looking for Penny Talbot," he says, his voice like cold water from the tap, his jaw a hardened line. "I was told I could find her down here." I stand up fully, trying to see his eyes, but there is a shadow cutting over the top half of his face. "Why are you looking for her?" I ask, not entirely certain I want to tell him that I am Penny Talbot just yet. "I found this up at the diner, the chowder," he says with an edge of uncertainty, like he's not sure he's remembered the name right. The Chowder is a small diner at the end of Shipley Pier that extends out over the water and has been voted Sparrow's best diner for the last 10 years in the local Ketch newspaper, a small print paper that employs a total of 2 people, one of which is Thor Grantson, because his father owns the paper. Thor is in the same class as me. During the school year, local kids overtake the Chowder. But in the summer months, we have to share the worn stools along the bar and the tables on the outdoor deck with the horde of tourists. "I'm looking for work," he adds, holding out the limp piece of paper for me to see. And then I realize what it is. I posted a note on the cork bulletin board inside the Chowder nearly a year ago, asking for help maintaining the lighthouse out on Lumiere Island, since my mom had become nearly incapable of doing anything, and I couldn't manage on my own. I had forgotten about posting it, and when no one ever came looking to fill the position, and the scribbled, handwritten note was eventually buried beneath other flyers and business cards, I made do. But now, somehow this outsider has found it among the clutter of papers tacked to the bulletin board. I don't need the help anymore, I say flatly, tossing the bow line into the boat, and also inadvertently revealing that I am, indeed, Penny Talbot. I don't want an outsider working on the island, someone who I know nothing about, who I can't trust. When I had posted the listing, I had hoped a laid-off fisherman or maybe someone from my school might have responded, but no one did.
You found someone else? He asks.
No, I just don't need anyone now. He scrubs a hand over his head, pushing back the hood that has shrouded his face, revealing stark, deep green eyes the color of the forest after it rains. He doesn't look like a drifter, grimy or like he's been showering in gas station bathrooms. He's my age, maybe a year or two older, but he still has the distinct look of an outsider, guarded and wary of his surroundings. He clenches his jaw and bites his lower lip, looking back over his shoulder to the shoreline, the town twinkling beneath the afternoon sun like it's been sprinkled with glitter. Are you here for the swan season? I ask, flattening my gaze on him.
The what?
He looks back at me, a measure of hardness in every move he makes, the twitch of an eyelash, the shifting of his lips before he speaks. Then why are you here? He obviously has no idea what the swan season is.
It was the last town on the bus line.
This is true. Sparrow is the final stop on a bus route that meanders up the coast of Oregon, stopping in several quaint seaside villages until it meets a dead end in Sparrow. The rocky ridgeline blocks any roads from continuing up the shore, so traffic has to be diverted inland for several miles.
You picked a bad time to end up in Sparrow, I say, unhooking the last rope, but holding on to it to keep the skiff from drifting back from the dock.
He pushes his hands into his jean pockets.
Why's that?
Tomorrow is June 1st. By his stiff, unaltered expression, I can tell he really has no idea what he's just stumbled into.
Sorry I can't help you, I say, instead of trying to explain all the reasons why he'd be better off just catching tomorrow's bus back out of here.
You can look for work at the cannery or one of the fishing boats, but they usually don't hire outsiders. He nods, biting his lip again and looking past me to the ocean, to the island in the distance.
What about a place to stay?
You can try one of the bed and breakfasts, but they're usually booked this time of year. Tourist season starts tomorrow.
June 1st?
He echoes, as if clarifying this mysterious date that obviously means something to me, but nothing to him.
Yeah.
I step inside the boat and pull the engine cord.
Good luck.
And I leave him standing on the dock as I motor across the bay toward the island. I look back several times and he's still there, watching the water as if unsure what to do next, until the final time I glance back, and he's gone. Chapter 3 The bonfire throws sparks up into the silvery night sky. Rose and I scramble down the uneven trail to Copper's Beach, the only stretch of shore in Sparrow that isn't bound in by rocks and steep cliffs. It's a narrow length of speckled white and black sand that ends at an underwater cave that only a few of the bravest and stupidest boys have ever attempted to swim into and then back out of.
Did you give her the forgetful cake?
Rose asks, like a doctor who's prescribed medication and wants to know if there were any ill side effects or positive results. After returning to Lumiere Island, after showering in the drafty bathroom across the hall from my bedroom, then staring at my small, rectangular closet, trying to decide what to wear to tonight's event, finally settling on white jeans and a thick black sweater that will keep out the night's chill, I went into the kitchen and presented my mom with Mrs. Alba's forgetful cake. She had been sitting at the table, staring into a cup of tea.
"Another one?"
she asked drearily, when I slid the cake in front of her. In Sparrow, superstition holds as much weight as the law of gravity or the predictability of the tide charts. And for most locals, Mrs. Alba's cakes have the same likelihood of helping Mom as would a doctor's bottle of pills. So she obediently took small bites of the lavender lemon petite four, careful not to spill a crumb onto her oversized tan sweater. The sleeves rolled halfway up her pale, bony forearms. I don't think she even realized today is the last day of school, that I just finished my junior year of high school, and that tomorrow is June 1st. It's not like she's completely lost all sense of reality, but the edges of her world have dulled, like hitting mute on the remote control. You can still see the picture buzzing on the TV. The colors are all there, but there's no sound. "I thought I saw him today," she muttered, standing on the shore below the cliff, looking up at me. Her lips quivered slightly, her fingers dropping a few crumbs of cake onto the plate in front of her. "But it was just a shadow, a trick of the light," she amended. "I'm sorry," I told her, touching her arm softly. I can still hear the sound of the screen door slamming shut the night my father left the house. Recall the way he looked walking down the path toward the dock. His shoulders bent away from the spray of the sea, his gait weary. I watched him leave on that stormy night 3 years earlier, and he never came back. He simply vanished from the island. His sailboat was still at the dock, his wallet on the side table by the front door of the house. No trace, no note, no clues. Sometimes I think I see him too. I tried to console her, but she stared at the cake in front of her, the features of her face soft and distant as she silently finished the last few bites. Sitting beside her at the kitchen table, I couldn't help but see myself in her. The long, straight brown hair, same liquid blue eyes and tragically pale skin that rarely sees the sun in this dreary place. But while she is polished and graceful with ballerina arms and gazelle legs, I have always felt knock-kneed and awkward. When I was younger, I used to walk bent forward, trying to appear shorter than the boys in my class. Even now, I often feel like a puppet whose master keeps pulling all the wrong strings so that I fumble and trip and hold my hands clumsily out in front of me. I don't think the cake is going to fix her, I tell Rose as we walk single file down the path lined with dry grass and thorny bushes. The memory of my dad's disappearance is so solidified in her mind that no amount of local remedies will strip it out. Well, I don't think my mom has given up yet. Today she was talking about a new mixture of bee pollen and primrose that she thinks might help unsnag the worst of memories. We finally reach the beach, and Rose hooks her arm through mine, our feet kicking up sand as we make our way to the bonfire. Most of the girls are wearing long, layered dresses with low necklines and ribbons tied in their hair. Even Rose has on a pale green gown made of lace and chiffon that sweeps across the sand when she moves, dragging bits of driftwood and shells along with her. Olivia Green and Lola Arthurs, best friends and the rulers of Sparrow's social elite, are dancing on the other side of the bonfire when we enter the crowd, obviously already intoxicated, which is no surprise to anyone. Their hair is an identical shade of gothic black with short, severe bangs, dyed and trimmed just 2 weeks ago for the swan season. Normally, their locks are bleached white, long and beachy, which will probably return in a month, when the swan season is over, and they aren't feeling the need to dress like death. But Olivia and Lola love the dramatic, love dressing up, love being the center of attention at any social gathering. Last year, they pierced each other's noses in defiance of their parents, Olivia's is a silver stud in her left nostril. Lola's is a hoop through the right. And their nails are painted a matching macabre black, a perfect complement to the hair. They spin in circles beside the bonfire, waving their arms in the air and lolling their heads from side to side as if to mimic the embodiment of a swan sister. Although I doubt the Swan Sisters ever did anything so idiotic-looking 200 years ago. Someone hands Rose a beer, and she in turn hands it to me to take the first sip. On weekends, sometimes we'll sneak beers or half-finished bottle of white wine from her parents' fridge, then get buzzed while stretched out on her bedroom floor listening to music. Lately, it's been country hits, our most recent obsession, and flipping through last year's yearbook, speculating about who's going to hook up this year and who might be inhabited by a swan sister come summer. I take a swig and look through the crowd at all the faces I recognize, at people who I've gone to school with since grade school, and I have the sharp thought that I hardly know any of them. Not really. I've had passing conversations with a few. Did you write down the chapters we were supposed to read tonight in Mr. Sullivan's third period history? Can I borrow a pen? Do you have a cell phone charger I can use? But to call any of them friends wouldn't just be a stretch. It would be an all-out lie. Maybe it's partly because I know most of them will leave this town eventually. They will go off to college and have lives far more interesting than mine. We're all just passing ships. No point forming friendships that won't last. And while Rose is not exactly climbing the social hierarchy at Sparrow High, she at least makes an effort to be friendly. She smiles at people in the halls, starts chatty conversations with her locker neighbors, and this year, Gigi Klein, cheerleading captain for our struggling basketball team, even invited her to try out for the squad. They were friends once, Gigi and Rose, in elementary school. Best friends, in fact. But friendships are more fluid in grade school. Nothing feels as permanent. And though they aren't exactly close anymore, Rose and Gigi have remained friendly. A tribute to Rose's kind nature. To the Swan Sisters, someone shouts. And to another fucking year of high school. Arms rise into the air, holding cans of beer and red cups, and a chorus of hoots and whistles carries across the beach. Music thumps from the stereo balanced on one of the logs near the bonfire. Rose takes the beer from me and shoves a larger bottle into my hand. Whiskey. It's being passed through the crowd. It's awful, she confesses, her face still puckered. But then she smiles, wagging an eyebrow at me. I chuck back a quick slog of the dark booze, and it burns my throat, sending goosebumps down my arms. I hand it off to my right, to Gigi Klein. She grins, not at me, she doesn't even seem to notice me, but down at the bottle as she takes it from my hands, tips it to her mouth, swallows down way more than I could ever manage, and then wipes at her perfect coral lips before passing the bottle to the girl on her right. 2 hours until midnight, a boy across the bonfire announces, and another wave of whoops and hollers rolls through the group. And those next 2 hours pass in a fog of bonfire smoke and more beers and swigs of whiskey that burn less and less with each sip. I hadn't planned on drinking or getting drunk, but the warmth radiating throughout my entire body makes me feel loose and floaty. Rose and I find ourselves swaying happily with people who we might normally never talk to, who might normally never talk to us. But when it's less than 30 minutes to midnight, the group begins to stagger down the beach to the water's edge. A few people, either too drunk or deep in conversation to leave the bonfire, stay behind, but the rest of us gather together as if forming a procession. Who's brave enough to go in first? Davis MacArthur's asks aloud so everyone can hear, his spiky blonde hair pushed up from his forehead, and his eyelids sagging lazily like he's about to take a nap. A rumble of low, furtive voices passes through the mob, and a few of the girls are pushed playfully forward, their feet splashing into the water only ankle deep before they scurry back out, as if a few inches of water were enough for the Swan Sisters to steal their human bodies. "I'll do it," a sing-song, slurring voice announces. Everyone cranes their head to see who it is, and Olivia Green steps forward, twirling in a circle so that her pastel yellow dress fans out around her like a parasol. She's obviously drunk, but the group cheers her on, and she bows forward as if greeting her adoring fans before turning to face the black, motionless harbor. Without any coaxing, she begins to wade out into the salty sea, arms outstretched. When she's waist deep, she does a very ungraceful dive forward, which looks more like a belly flop. She disappears from view for half a second before reappearing at the surface, laughing wildly with her tragic black hair draped over her face like seaweed. The crowd cheers, and Lola steps into the water up to her knees, urging Olivia back to the shallows. Davis MacArthur's calls again for volunteers, and this time there is only a half beat before a voice shouts, "I'll go in." I snap my gaze to the left, where Rose has stepped out of the crowd, moving toward the water. "Rose," I bark, reaching out and grabbing her arm. "What are you doing?"
"Going for a swim."
"No, you can't."
"I've never really believed in the Swan Sisters anyway," she says with a wink,
and the crowd pulls her from my grasp, ushering her toward the cold ocean. She smiles widely as she wades out into the water, past Olivia. She's barely up to her waist when she dives forward and slips beneath the surface. A ripple shudders out behind her, and everyone on the beach falls silent. The air constricts in my lungs. The water flattens against the surface, and even Olivia, who's still calf-deep in the shallows, turns to watch. But Rose doesn't reappear. 15 seconds pass. 30. My heart starts to clap against my chest, a painful certainty that something isn't right. I push out from the crowd, suddenly sober, watching for Rose's red hair to break through the surface. But there's not even a breeze. Not even a ripple. I take a single step into the water. I have to go in after her. I don't have a choice. When beneath the bloodless half moon, shattering the calm, she suddenly bursts above the waterline, reemerging several yards farther out into the harbor from where she went in. I let out a trembling sigh of relief, and the crowd erupts in a collective cheer, raising their cups as if they just witnessed some impossible feat. Rose flips onto her back and lifts her arms overhead in a fluid pinwheel, swimming toward shore, casual as if she were doing laps in a pool. I expect Davis MacArthur's to ask who else wants to go in, but the crowd has gotten rowdy, and girls are now traipsing through the shallow, ankle-deep water, but never actually going all the way in. People stretch out on the sand, some shotgun beers, and others do sloppy cartwheels into the water. Rose finally reaches the beach, and I try to push over to her, but several senior guys have gathered around her, giving her high fives and offering her beers. I slink back from the group. She shouldn't have done that. Gone into the water. Risked it. My cheeks blaze, watching her nonchalantly wipe the water from her arms as if she is pleased with herself, smiling up at the cluster of guys who've taken a sudden interest in her. The moonlight makes a path up the beach, and I wander away from the noise of the party. Not far, just enough to catch my breath. I drank too much, and the world is starting to buzz and crackle and tilt off axis. I think of my father vanishing on a night when there was no moon to see by, no stars to guide his way back from the dark. If there had been a moon, maybe he would have returned to us. I consider heading back to the marina, ditching the party and returning to the island, when I hear the heavy breathing and staggered footsteps of someone stumbling up the sandy beach behind me. "Hey," a voice calls. I spin around and see Lon Whittemer,
one of Sparrow High's notorious partiers, swaying toward me like I'm standing in his path.
"Hi,"
I answer softly, trying to step out of his way so he can continue his drunken walk up the beach.
"You're Pearl," he says.
"No, Paisley." He laughs, tosses his head back, his brown eyes slipping closed briefly before focusing on me again.
"Don't tell me," he says, holding up a finger in the air as if to stop me from giving away my name before he's had time to figure it out on his own.
"Priscilla. Pinstripe. You're just saying things that start with the letter P." I'm not in the mood for this. I just want to be left alone.
"Penny!" he shouts, cutting me off.
I take a step back as he leans forward, exhaling a boozy breath and almost falling into me. His dark brown hair is plastered to his forehead, and his narrow-set eyes seem unable to focus, blinking closed every couple seconds. He's wearing a neon orange shirt with palm trees and pink flamingos scattered across it. Lon likes to wear obnoxious Hawaiian shirts in all shades of bright tropical colors with exotic birds and pineapples and hula girls. I think it started as a joke, or maybe a dare our sophomore year, and then it turned into his trademark style. It makes him look like an 80-year-old man on permanent vacation in Palm Springs. And since I don't think he's ever been to Palm Springs, his mother must order them online. And tonight, he's wearing one of his ugliest.
"I like you, Penny. I always have," he mumbles.
"Is that right?"
"Yep. You're my kind of girl."
"I doubt that. You didn't even know my name 2 seconds ago." Lon Whittemer's parents own the only major grocery store in town, Lon's Grocery, which they named after him. And he's known for being a total narcissistic asshole. He considers himself a ladies' man, a self-proclaimed Casanova, only because he can offer his girlfriends discounts on makeup in the meager cosmetics aisle at his parents' store. And he uses this like a gold trophy he only hands out to girls who are worthy. But he's also known for cheating on his girlfriends, and has been caught numerous times making out with other girls in his jacked-up, chrome-rimmed, mud-flap-accessorized red truck parked in the school parking lot. Basically, he's a moron who doesn't even deserve the breath it takes to tell him to get lost.
"Why didn't you go in the water?"
he asks slyly, inching closer to me again.
"Like your friend did."
He brushes his hair back from his forehead, and it sticks up straight, either from sweat or seawater. "I didn't want to."
"You're afraid of the Swan Sisters?"
"Yeah, I am," I answer honestly. His eyes slide partway closed, and a stupid grin curls across his lips.
"Maybe you should swim with me."
"No, thanks. I'm going back to the party."
"You didn't even wear a dress,"
he points out, and his eyes slide down my body like he's shocked by my appearance. "Sorry to disappoint you." I start to take a step around him, but he grabs hold of my arm and digs his fingers into my skin.
"You can't just walk away."
He hiccups, closes his eyes again, then snaps them open like he's trying to stay awake.
"We haven't swum yet."
"I told you I'm not getting in the water."
"Sure you are."
He smiles playfully, like I must be enjoying this as much as he is, and begins dragging me with him into the shallows.
"Stop it."
I use my other hand to push against his chest, but he continues to lurch backward, deeper into the harbor.
"Stop!"
I shout this time.
"Let me go."
I look up the shore to the mass of people, but they're all too loud and drunk and distracted to hear me.
"Just one swim," he coos, still smiling, slurring each word as they tumble from his lips.
We've staggered calf deep into the water, and I slam my fist against his chest. He winces briefly, and then his expression changes, turns angry, and his eyes go wide.
"Now you're going all the way in,"
he announces more crisply, yanking against my arm so that I stumble several steps deeper, up to my knees. Not deep enough to risk being taken by a swan sister, but still my heart begins to thump, fear pushing the blood out to my extremities and sending panic racing down my veins. I raise my arm again, ready to punch him directly in the face to keep him from dragging me any further, when someone appears to my left. Someone I don't recognize. It all happens in an instant. The stranger shoves a hand against Lon's chest. Lon's throat lets out a short wheezing sound. His grip on my arm releases at the same time he loses his balance, and suddenly, he's careening backward, falling all the way into the water, arms flailing. I take a staggering step back, sucking in air, and the person who pushed Lon off me touches my arm to steady me.
"You okay?" he asks.
I nod, my heart rate not yet receding. Lon, a few feet away, stands up from the waist-deep water, gagging and coughing and wiping seawater from his face. His bright orange shirt is now sopping wet.
"What the fuck?"
he yells, looking directly at the stranger standing beside me.
"Who do you think you are?"
Lon demands, marching toward us. And for the first time, I really look up at the face of the stranger, trying to place him. The rigid angle of his cheekbones and the straight slope of his nose. And then I know. It's him. The boy from the dock who was looking for work. The outsider. He's wearing the same black sweatshirt and dark jeans, but he's standing closer now, and I can clearly see the features of his face. The small scar by his left eye, the way his lips come together in a flat line, his short, dark hair flecked with droplets of mist from the sea air. His gaze is still hard and unflinching, but in the moonlight, he seems more exposed, like I might be able to read some clue in the rim of his eyes or the shiver of his throat when he swallows. But I don't have time to ask him what he's doing out here, because Lon is suddenly in his face, shouting about what an asshole he is and how he's going to get his face punched in for having the nerve to shove Lon into the water like that. But the boy doesn't even flinch. His gaze looks down at Lon, who is a good 6 inches shorter than him, and even though the muscles in his neck tense, he seems wholly unconcerned by Lon's threats of an ass-kicking. When Lon finally takes a breath, the boy raises an eyebrow, like he wants to be sure Lon is done babbling before he responds. "Forcing a girl to do anything she doesn't want to do is reason enough to kick your ass," he begins, his voice level. "So I suggest you apologize to her and save yourself a trip to the ER for stitches and a raging headache in the morning." Lon blinks, opens his mouth to speak, to spew some rebuttal that would probably involve more cuss words than actual substance. But then thinks better of it and snaps his jaw shut. Standing beside the two of them, it's obvious Lon is outweighed, outmuscled, and probably outexperienced. And he must see it too, because he turns his head to face me, swallows his pride, and mutters, "I'm sorry." I can tell it pains him to say it, his expression twisting in disgust, the words sharp and foreign in his mouth. He's probably never apologized to a girl in his life. Maybe never apologized to anyone ever. Then he turns and slogs up the beach back to the group, trailing seawater from his soaked clothes. "Thank you," I say, wading out of the shallow water. My shoes and the lower half of my white jeans are drenched. The boy's shoulders relax for the first time.
"That guy wasn't your boyfriend, was he?"
"God, no," I snap, shaking my head. "Just some self-entitled prick from school. I've never even talked to him before." He gives me a half nod and glances past me to the party in full swing.
Music thumps. Girls squeal and skip along the edge of the waterline. Boys rush.